The greatest gift you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous is you. That's the greatest gift you're going to get. Because you haven't got a clue what a wonderful person you are. You can't even imagine it yet. And if you stay here, they're going to force all of the false ideas out of you. They're going to take away the wrappings and the garbage. And you're going to start to shine. And other people are going to see it way before you do. They're going to see your eyes changing. And they're going to see your whole posture and your whole being start changing. And eventually you're going to become aware of it. And when you do, you'll probably feel like crying. You will be so happy to find out how wrong you were about everything. The greatest freedom you can have is to enjoy being wrong. So if you have a tough sponsor, tell them to get even tougher. Because there's something inside of you that is going to just please you for the rest of your life.
Welcome home, friend, to Sober Shares Podcast, Episode 76. My name is Michael, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been sober since October 10th of the year 2000. The purpose of this show is to spread hope that recovery from alcohol and drug addiction is possible. I am glad you are here, and I hope you find what you are looking for. This podcast's only means of support are donations made by listeners. All funds will be used to pay our monthly operating expenses. This is not a for-profit venture. I want to keep these episodes advertisement-free, so please help support us by visiting SoberShares.com and clicking the donate button. Please email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to Mike@SoberShares.com. And now, let's visit the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, California, circa 2011.
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Yvonne F.
I'd like to thank Nathan for the honor of speaking at my home group tonight. But if you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here to AA, my sobriety date is February 10th, 1994. I was 21 years old, and the last place I wanted to be was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought AA was about the lamest thing I could be sent to. I wanted no part of it. The only reason I stayed in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is that Child Protective Services made it a requirement if I wanted to maintain custody of my daughter, and I did. I had gone without her, and I did not want to go without her any longer, and so I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I want you to know that I learned early on that it doesn't matter what I think, and it doesn't matter how I feel. In fact, I don't think I've ever had a sponsor who really cared much about how I felt at all. What has mattered to me in Alcoholics Anonymous are the actions I take, and thankfully I've had good sponsorship and good groups who have taught me good action, and my life started to change despite myself, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to drink. I got drunk for the first time when I was 4 years old. It's kind of a fluke, but my sister's 8 years older, and she was kind of a wild party girl at the time. She's an Al-Anon, not an alcoholic. She went through her wild and crazy phase when she was like 12 to 17, and she got me drunk. And I just remember, I didn't get drunk a lot when I was four, but I do remember the feeling of intoxication. I remember loving the feeling. It reminded me of spinning around, you know, until you got dizzy enough to fall down. I've always loved the feeling of getting loaded. So my sister, when I was 8 years old, she ended up getting sent to a teenage treatment facility. And after that, she was able to drink like a gentleman. So she is not an alcoholic. But I had my first drink without my sister when I was 11 years old. And what happened is I was at my girlfriend Heather's house. I was spending the weekend there, and her parents were out of the country. And her older sisters were in high school, and they were babysitting us. And I knew when I was little, and my sister used to take me around her friends, she used to tell these big guys she hung out with, She would say, my little sister can drink you all under the table. And I know as an adult that wasn't true, but I just remember being little and just feeling a lot of pride about it and feeling like I fit in. And my sister was my idol. She was beautiful and I wanted to be just like her. And so when I was 11 years old at my girlfriend Heather's house, I noticed that her high school sisters were sitting around the kitchen table drinking something called Seagram 7. And I wanted to get drunk. And so I walked up to those girls and I put my hands on my hips and I said, you know, I could drink you all under the table. And they laughed, but they gave me a liter of 7 and 7. And I don't remember anything that happened that night. I apparently have been a blackout drinker since I was 11, so you can see why I would get here when I was 21. The only thing I can tell you about that experience is that when I woke up the next morning, I was lying on the basement floor. It was not a finished floor. It was in Virginia. It was cold concrete. I was in my training bra. And there weren't any boys in the house, but yeah, I found my clothes on the third level. I had urinated in them sometime during the night. So, you know, I was a great drinker at 11. Nothing much changed. You know, I didn't drink like that all the time. I could just never predict when my night was going to end up like that. And I ended up going to New York City and wanting to be an actress. And that didn't really, I ended up on stage, but, it was not a stage my Catholic mother was very proud of. I ended up back down in D.C. just to get the heat off. And I found myself in short order pregnant. I'm a garden variety alcoholic, but from time to time I've had brief love affairs with heroin as well. And I found myself, you know, when I was pregnant, having to go on methadone. And when my daughter was born, she had a detox in the neonatal intensive care unit for 16 days. And I was really sorry. I knew I could just control and enjoy my drinking. If I would just stick with drinking, it was going to be okay. And it just never worked out like that for me. For the first 9 months of my daughter's life, we lived in row houses in D.C. where, you know, sometimes there were no windows, no running water, no electricity. And I ended up calling my mother when she was 9 months old, telling my mom that she could have my daughter if she would bring me $20. And I lost custody of my daughter then, as I should have. I ended up working in Baltimore on the block there. I didn't get to see my little girl for 4 months, and I really missed her. I didn't think sobriety was the answer for me, but I knew I wanted to see my little girl back. And my mom gave me a call in February of 94 and told me she found a facility that took mothers and babies, and if I would go in there, I could have my little girl back. I didn't have any other answers that day, and I just really desperately wanted to see her, and so I went in, and I don't count my detox as part of my sobriety, but I got out of detox as physically sober as I am today, and like I said, that's February 10th, 1994, and that's the day I got custody of that little girl back. And a lot of people in this room, you know my daughter. I'm so proud of her. Sorry. You know, my daughter's sitting in this room tonight because she's almost 3 years sober. You know, you guys have been a great example to her. We were talking before the meeting, some of us, and how, like, children who grew up in AA, some of their misperceptions, you know, like the time I walked in the living room and she was having an argument with some cousins and she was yelling at them, alcoholics don't drink alcohol. And they thought, you know, they were like, what's wrong with you? Alcoholics drink alcohol. No, they don't. Mommy, tell them, you know. She was five. Okay. She was five. You guys have been such a great example to her. And I'm just so grateful for that. And I didn't want to be an AA when I got, I'm so pleased, Nathan. Thank you. Our speaker tonight is a great part of my story because I got sober in DC and he used to live there. And I went through a particular detox a couple of times that took us to, NIH where he used to do these 12-step workshops or, you know, I don't really remember. I was always detoxing and so I always sat in the back. And I was always sleeping. They're comfortable seats, like here, and you can fall asleep, and it's great. But when I was 11 months sober, I went to, like, a local Olano club, and my treatment facility was making me go to meetings every time I had a pass. And I used to argue with them, like, that's my entire pass. You know, like, I don't get to do anything fun. You know, and I used to tell them, I'll never go to AA again once I'm out of here. You guys, there's no point in making me now, and I went to this local Olano club and I saw this flyer and there was a group that was putting on a spaghetti dinner and Sandy was going to be the speaker. And I remembered that when I had been at NIH, I had this memory, because his name is unusual, I had remembered him, and I remembered that there was something he shared one night, or one morning, and it made me laugh. And the reason I remember is because I remember having the thought after my laughter of, why are you laughing in an AA meeting? This is like so lame, you know? And so when I saw his name on the flyer, I thought, that's the man that made me laugh that time. So I asked permission from my facility if I could go to that meeting, and I don't remember much of what he said that night, but I was introduced to people who were enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it started to change my mind about AA. And I'm so grateful for that. And, you know, the last thing I'll tell you is that I had a difficult time with the God concept here. I had an eye injury, and it was really bad. I went blind in my left eye. I was seeing doctors at Johns Hopkins 7 days a week. On Sunday, I saw the on-call surgeon making the rounds, and I just, you know, the whole thing was terrible, but I just, like, up until that time, I was agnostic. I didn't know how I was ever going to get the feeling of God, how that would ever happen for me. And one night, the doctor told me, 50-50, you're going to lose your eye altogether in the next week, and I was really devastated about it. And I went home. I had been having to put eye drops in my eye every half an hour, 24 hours a day, and I didn't have to set an alarm clock because I had so much physical pain, I couldn't sleep 30 minutes. And someone at my meeting that night told me to go home and pray for the removal of the obsession I had with my eye, and I just hated her. And I went home that night, and after trying to figure out if I could plot her demise for a couple of hours, I got down on my knees, and I said something like, God, please remove the obsession I have. When I woke up the next morning, most of the pain was gone, and the doctors had no medical explanation, and I received my greatest gift that day, a relationship with God. I wanted you guys to know that you have changed everything in my life, and I love you. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is David B.
My name is David. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 3rd, 1993. My sponsor is Clancy Emisland, and this is my home group. I was born in this goofy little suburb of Detroit, Michigan. It seemed like you guys had the owner's manual to life, and I didn't get it. I just didn't know how to live life. I kind of stumbled around. My dad drank. He drank until what we called it falling asleep. My mother was kind of a finger pointer. Now, maybe she qualified for Al-Anon. I don't know. I was terrified of that woman. She was a very strong personality. She always pointed her finger at my dad, and he was a, you know, terrible alcoholic. Well, she didn't use the word alcohol. He just drank too much. That was her way of putting it. So I didn't drink. I was terrified. And I'll tell you about my brother. I have a normal brother. In about my second or third year of sobriety, we went over to Catalina. He was visiting from Houston, where he lives. And he ordered a beer, and he drank about half of it. You know, I just couldn't not look at that remaining half of the... But anyway, he's very normal, been married a long time, has a couple of daughters who are in college, and he's a good employee, good husband. I don't know how he got those skills, same parents that I have in the same household. But in any event, I didn't drink in high school. I envied you guys who drank and drove the hot cars. When I graduated from high school, I got a scholarship to a Midwestern version of USC. You know, talk about feeling not a part of. I came from this little town, this suburb of Detroit. Everybody at this university seemed to have money. This was the 60s. And, you know, now they say, just say no to drugs. But in the 60s, we said, just say thank you. See, normally I don't like people. Don't take that personally, but... I'm just uncomfortable around people, and this, I became very comfortable. It allowed me to do certain things in the back seats of cars that I wouldn't otherwise have done. You know, my social life took off. When I'm drinking, I'm very comfortable with whoever's there. I like you. And the other things augment that. So my grades kind of dropped, but my social life took off. I did graduate from that university and went on to medical school. If any of you have been my patients and I owe you an amends, please see me after the break. In medical school, we had a drug called Ambar. I don't think it's around anymore, but it was a mixture of amphetamines and barbiturate in the same capsule. So, you know, you got active, but it kind of kept a lid on it. So, you know, I graduated medical school, came out here to Southern California, followed my dad, who followed the sunshine, and I followed the sunshine. If any of you spent any time in the Middle West, in Detroit or Chicago or any of those cities, it can be pretty glum year-round. But I got out here, I met a woman, she was attracted to whatever, and we got married, and she and I drank together. There used to be these magazine ads. We were found at finer restaurants and bars everywhere. You know, I was comfortable with that, as long as I was drinking. Of course, I usually, as we say, miss the mark. Well, I call it falling asleep. I fell asleep, and my wife would drive us home. In the early 80s, I was having a weight problem. Somebody brought me to a 12-step program with regard to food. That was my first exposure to the 12 steps. And they have very small meetings. And they open them with the Serenity Prayer, and there was a peace and a quiet in the room. And that attracted me to the 12-step process. My family, first of all, I was chaotic. And my kids, by that time we had, I think, 4 kids already. And my wife and I were getting along, and the kids were screaming, how kids are. So there was a peace and quiet in that room that attracted me. And then right after that, somebody brought me to Al-Anon. So, I could point my finger. They say if you're pointing your finger, there's 3 pointing back at you, and that's what I learned. Anyway, I started to detach. Now, that's what they teach in Al-Anon, detach with love. But I forgot, I didn't understand the with love part. I just, kind of abandoned my wife and my family. Pretty soon she filed for divorce. And in divorce court, the judge wants you to pay some monies for support monies for these kids. And they use a formula. I used a different formula, and I came up with a different amount, and that's what I paid. And you can do that for only so long, and then pretty soon, you're going out, and I spent some time at what's now Men's Central. At that time, it's the main L.A. County jail. I looked around the jail. I didn't see any of my colleagues there. Being in jail makes you depressed. I was very depressed when they let me out. So I went over to UCLA to get some, medical help, some psychological, psychiatric help. And in the emergency room, the guy asked me, he said, "Do you want to kill yourself?" And I said, "Oh, no, I want to kill my effing wife." He brings out a pad of paper, and he starts to write what's known as a 5150 hold, and I'm pretty soon... Anyway, a woman who I knew from Overeaters Anonymous, somehow we got talking, and she saw what a mess my life was. I was no longer practicing my profession out of spite, so I wouldn't have to pay my wife money. Anyway, she told me about this meeting. She said, "I can't go with you that particular night, but what you do is there'll be a line." We at that time, the line was out in front. She said, "Just go and wait in line." Now, I was very depressed, so I had stopped shaving, had hair everywhere. I don't see him, Michael Blanc. I know he's here tonight. But anyway, he was at the end of the line. And I walk up, and he takes about 2 steps back and says, are you new?" Coming here was the best thing I ever did. First of all, I raised my hand and identified as an alcoholic. And now I understand that kind of identification for a person of my type who always feels different is very important. I could identify with you guys by raising my hand and declaring myself to be an alcoholic. I met Clancy. Now, I know this isn't how you guys know him, but when he smiled at me, there seemed to be like a glow. I've experienced some otherwise since then. He typecast me as a newcomer, goofy newcomer in one of the first New Year's Eve play that I was there. I had a couple, just 2 short lines, but I was so vermished, as we say in my ethnic group, I couldn't remember these lines. So on about the third rehearsal, he comes right up to my face, he goes, "Damn it, David, why don't you learn your lines?" And he says, "Love is the answer." Anyway, somebody circled meetings for me. I went to 7 meetings. I got commitments. I pushed the broom, set up chairs, whatever you guys told me to do. I went to the yard. I knew nothing about softball. You know, the ball would come. I was looking at the airplanes. You know, I learned to hold my glove up. You told me which end of the bat to hold, and I learned to swing. You know, little by little, my life got better and better. I'm so grateful. At the beginning, what do these meetings and what does this big book? My problems are way different. I've got significant problems. They said, look, just come to the meetings, just do what we do, follow along. Your problems will gradually resolve. And that's exactly what happened. The judge asked me to pay a little money. I went back to court. I paid a little bit of money at Clancy's direction, paid a little more. Gradually, my kids came back in my life. One of my children is sober now several years here, more than 10 years, actually. Today's her natal birthday. Olivia, I love you. If you're new, I welcome you. This is, it's an odd process, but it works. Again, Nathan, thank you very much, and thank you all.
Our main speaker tonight is Sandy B.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can't tell you how happy I am to be here tonight. I really love Los Angeles AA. I have a lot of friends out here. And due to health reasons and other things, I've had to cancel several trips to come out here in the last 2 or 3 years. So this is really special for me. And next year, I'm really looking forward to going down to the Laguna Group and see my hero Chuck's home group and talk to people that knew him, and so that's going to be special. I got sober on December 7th, 1964, up in Washington, D.C., and my home group is the Saturday Night Fever group in Tampa, Florida. If you're ever down there, come on over. We'll try and show you that we can get the energy level up a little high there, and you'll probably enjoy it. Before I get started, I wanted to thank everybody for the cards that you sent me last year when my daughters died. I have, I don't know how many there are, but they came from all over, AA groups, individuals. And in my living room, I have memorials to each daughter. And it consists of a basket filled with the cards that came from AA people all over. And then the program from their memorial service. And it's very simple, but it's the most powerful thing you can imagine. And it'll be there forever as far as I'm concerned. And my remaining daughter, who's in AA, came down to visit me, I guess about a month and a half ago. And she spent hours reading those cards, and it just, I can't tell you, I know there's people in here that were involved in sending those, and they mean a lot to my family, and I want to thank everybody. And the other thing I wanted to do is to tell you a couple of lessons that I got out of that. I'm not going to dwell on it, but I think it's important. Because of other people, other teachers, I saw certain things prior to these events happening, where my one daughter was murdered and the other one died of alcoholism. And because of that, the way that I was, the gift I was given on how to handle that was quite helpful. And so if any of you ever go through shocking things, I'm just going to give you these little thoughts. When you get the news, you have a period of time before you react to it. It's sort of a given. Normally you'll go, well, I'll go sit down and then I'll let it sink in. So I'm just saying we're all given that. And the gift is to use that time to go right to God. Don't react to the situation yet. Go to God and just say, God, I want to do something first before I react to this. I want to assure you that I will not change how I feel about you. You will always be first. And I just want to reassure you that this is not going to change how I feel about you. Then go back to the situation, and guess who comes with you? And you're just given a whole different way of seeing things. And in my case, I found that I was able to forgive and accept that day. And I learned that the power of acceptance really exists in doing it in the moment that it happens, instead of waiting 3 months to finally accept something, or to wait 3 years before you forgive someone. So that's enough on that, but I just wanted to tell you that it was the most powerful thing. And the reason it's so powerful is it eliminates resentment, hatred, and anger, and all that's left is sorrow. And God will help you with sorrow. It's the easy way is to always involve God. Anyway, enough of that, but I wanted to thank everybody for what you meant to my family.
And now let's take a quick break and talk about SoberShares.com. You can visit our website to listen to all of our episodes, leave us a show review, and access our social media pages on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also email me directly at mike@SoberShares.com. A financial donation to the show may be made by clicking the PayPal donate button on our website. This process is simple, and your generosity will allow us to continue to bring you this show advertisement-free. Your generosity will help us meet our monthly operating expenses. Thank you for your consideration. I would like to mention a few listeners by name who recently made a financial gift to move this project forward. Thank you to David D., Daniel F., Richard B., and Francesca A. David D., with his donation, left a note within the PayPal note section. It says, "Love your podcast, Mike. Keep it going." So thank you, David D. And now let's get back to our guest. Take it away, Sandy Beach.
I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I was born in 1931. The main event of my childhood was World War II. It was a big deal. I hadn't started drinking yet, but I had learned a couple tricks as a child that came in handy. I learned how to think about things in a way that made my life miserable. It's a nice trick, and if you keep working at it, you can get better and better as the years go on, until you can ruin good news by just... Then you know you're on your way to becoming an alcoholic. Now, we don't take credit normally for this weird thinking. We blame it on things around us because we're never the ones that's at fault. And so I think I blame my parents for being too nice to me, and Catholic Church for scaring me in the confessionals and all those things. But it really was bizarre thinking about me. I spent a lot of time sitting around thinking about me and what's going on around me. And I made up a lot of stories about what was going on, because what was really going on was probably kind of boring. So I turned it into tragedies, and people are conniving against me, and this is unfair, and I'm terrified, and I'm probably going to die soon, and I'm worthless, and God never made a worse child, those kind of thoughts. It's a little hard to sleep, but you become very familiar with misery, anxiety, restless, irritable, discontent. And I haven't, you know, I'm not even 12 years old yet. So you can see I got very good at this early on. And then later on, once I got into drinking, you get into advanced storytelling and advanced believing of storytelling. So anyway, with that sort of discontent and restlessness inside of me, I was trying to make a go of life. I was very popular. People liked me. I was a good student. I was a good athlete. People liked to be around me, but I didn't like being around me. I felt just uncomfortable. I just knew if they really knew me. Yeah, it's the same story that just about everybody has. And so when I got old enough to go to college, I went to Yale, which was our hometown school, and I felt very inadequate there. The people came from all over the country, and they were smarter than I was and richer and famous and all that, and I just could barely survive in a social sense. And when I was 19, I had my first drink at a little social event, and it took about three drinks for me to see the world as a friendly place. That was the magic of alcohol. Prior to alcohol, people were intimidating. Nobody liked me. Three drinks later, everyone loved me. I could see it in their eyes. I just ran around talking to people freely. My creativity came out. All the anxiety was gone, and I could at last be me. And I remember just going, this is unbelievable. I almost had the thought, I should have started drinking in grammar school. I could have saved so much trouble that I was having. It was like a gift. And that's why I'm an alcoholic, is that I had that reaction. My friends who were drinking around the same time that I was, they thought alcohol was fun, that it made you have fun at a party. I didn't see it that way. Alcohol solved everything. It was the answer to life. I had been looking for the solution to life, and there it was. And so it became the top priority, and studies went out the window, athletics went out the window. Now I'm getting in fights, now I'm getting in trouble, and I barely graduated. The Korean War draft was still on. Everybody had to join the military, and we had some beers. And about six of us decided to join the Marine Corps. Sounded like a great thing to do after a half a case of beer. Go on down and sign up for the Marine Corps. And after the initial shock, the Marine Corps has a way of greeting you that is quite a unique. But you know you've been greeted when they get through. And after about 6 months, I started to fall in love with it. I just felt like I was part of something, and it made me feel comfortable. I just lost all that whatever made me nervous beforehand, and I decided that I wanted to make it a career. So I went from knowing nothing about the military to wanting to make it a career. And at the end of infantry training, I saw a training movie about pilots, and it looked wonderful. I had never been in an airplane, but I knew I wanted to sign up for flight school. And I went over and signed up for it, and got married. Got orders to Pensacola, Florida, this lovely woman. We had six children together. And I got airsick on the plane down to Pensacola. And I got airsick in the old SNJ, but after about a month, the motion sickness went away, and I suddenly was home. This is where I belonged. I would be number one or number two or number three in each phase as we went through flight school, the going aboard the carrier, the night flying, and the formation, all that stuff. And by the time I got to Texas and got my wings, I was the happiest guy in the world. I just said, boy, I have really lucked out. And I got some training in El Toro, California, not too far from here. I was down there when Disneyland was built. And I got orders overseas, and the war was over. So I got to Japan, and I was in a great fighter squadron, and everyone drank as much as I did. That's what it seemed like. The colonel would order the drinks. We just sat around. We flew all day long and then went into the club. And I said, this is just the greatest thing in the world. I was like, how could it be more exciting? And I'd been there about 9 months when the maintenance officer and I were out in the end of the runway watching our buddies get ready to go aboard the carrier. And he started talking about getting promoted, get his own squadron. And he pointed at me and he said, and I want a pilot like you. I want nothing but the best. And as a young lieutenant, I just went, man, this is so cool. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink in the squadron. And here's a guy I'm getting drunk with all the time. And he makes a statement, so I never asked him about that. It was too frightening to even think what he might have meant. But when I got to AA, I realized what was going on. My drinking scared heavy drinkers. They saw something going on that they weren't familiar with. They were overseas for a year. They were just going to party and have a good time and then go home. They weren't sure what I was doing. I was at another level than they were at, and it frightened them. And so people saw the difference early on. I just thought I was the same as everybody else and went on. I had 14 years in the Marine Corps before they got rid of me for drinking. I had some wonderful assignments. I was with the 1st Marine Division down at Camp Pendleton. And I was a flight instructor, and then I was with Jim over here in VMCJ 2 at Cherry Point during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was the end of my career. I had started to develop withdrawal symptoms in the airplane when I was flying. The disease had just progressed to that point. And so I wouldn't drink for 8 or 10 hours, and that was the worst possible thing you could do because I was coming close to having a seizure or something. There was no AA. There was no alcohol programs. I never heard of AA. So I decided I'm just going to have to survive this. And I would get in the planes, and I never knew what was going to happen. It might be all right, or I might be flying around with one hand on the ejection seat and fly the other hand. The stick had all the cameras and stuff, so you could get away with that. And my thinking was that if I passed out, I'd pull the curtain, I would eject, the chute would open automatically at 10,000 feet, the plane would crash, I'd be fine, and I had the feeling, wow, I just solved the problem. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't seem bizarre that particular solution that I came up with. And the end came on a cross country, and this was so amazing when I was at Brentwood about 4 years ago. Anyway, we were in a flight of 4 airplanes, and I decided that I had to get out of the plane. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I felt like I was going to pass out. A panic was setting in, and it was a old F-3D radar plane. It had 2 people in it, one radar guy and the pilot, and I realized if I left the plane, this guy didn't know how to fly. And so I was going to have to do something, so I declared an oxygen emergency, which means you have to land right away because there's something wrong with the oxygen. And so all 4 planes went down to some Air Force base. We went to the club. I had a few drinks. I felt better. But the next morning, when I went down to the flight line, I told the flight leader that I wasn't going to fly anymore. Alcohol had decided that my favorite thing my whole life, I was going to give up that morning. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. Why? I'm just not going to do it. So somebody else flew us back, and I had to go see the colonel, and he wanted to know, what are you talking about, Sandy? You've been at this all these years. I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He finally had to take me seriously and send in the paperwork to headquarters Marine Corps to get me a new assignment. And I had 3 months waiting for the reassignment, and I was so embarrassed I couldn't look at the other pilots. It was just total shame. I did the legal work for the 3 months, and finally I transferred out of there, and about a year later I got so bad that the Marine Corps got rid of me. Anyway, a lot of people have heard this, but at Brentwood 4 years ago, I was getting ready to talk. Jim's wife was coming up to get her 30-year medallion and was talking to Jim and said, Sandy Beach is leading to me. He says, was he a pilot? And Jim's not in AA, but he comes around a lot. And he said, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here and talk to me. So I went outside, and there's Jim standing there. I've never seen the man in my life. And he looks at me and said, In 1962, you were in a flight of four F-3Ds on a cross country, and you declared an oxygen emergency, and the planes had to land, and you never flew again. And I said, well, how'd you know that? And he said, I was in the plane with you. And so, and I went, really? And he said, it turns out he wasn't a radar guy. He was an airline pilot that had been recalled for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we were on a hurricane evacuation, which is why all the pilots went, because when hurricanes come to bases, you fly all the planes where it's safe, you drink until the hurricane leaves, and then you fly home. So that's pretty choice duty, and there isn't any radar guys going to go on that. And he came up the next day to the Oxnard convention and brought photographs from the squadron and all that. And that would be a wonderful story in itself, but what he said next was the most important thing. He said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? Did you know how much everybody liked you? It broke everybody's heart that you had to leave. The colonel did everything he could. We were trying to do it, and then when you left, we were so sad. And I went to myself, well, that's not the way I remember it. I remember everybody looking at me with contempt and feeling all that shame. So I had to go back to 1962 and change the past and put the truth in. And I submit to you that a lot of sobriety consists in doing exactly that. Going back and getting rid of your ideas about what happened and putting in what really happened. I heard a speaker many years ago, he started his talk with kind of a funny line. My stories divide into two parts, what happened during the years that I drank and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. And people really enjoyed that. But now that I've been working the program for all these years, I realize that you could say that about any part of your life. Your childhood's divided into two parts. What happened when you were a child and what you thought happened when you were a child. High school was divided into two parts. What happened and what you thought happened. And when we go through the steps, especially through 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, we get to see our life from a different perspective. And we have an entirely different perception after we get through talking with our sponsor about each one of these items and after we finish making amends. And life is only perception. There's no other reality than perception. And so the way I saw it was official as far as I was concerned. And I reacted emotionally to the way I decided that things had happened. And when I plugged in the truth, I reacted quite differently. I was very comfortable with it. I was very happy to see the world in an entirely different fashion. They talk about us, our problem being self-centeredness. And I think it is the most perfect explanation of our problem is self-centeredness. And I remember when my sponsor finally trapped me in a corner where I had to admit that maybe I was self-centered. And I said, okay, I see that now. I guess I am self-centered. I said, I'm going to work on that, Bill. I'm going to do something about being self-centered. He said, oh, really? Like what? I said, well, I'm going to become unself-centered. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop being self-centered. He said, well, explain how you are going to not be self-centered. Go ahead and just show me. Give me I could stand over there. I would be in a different place. I mean, I had no idea. How are you going to not be self-centered? Turns out the only way out is to become God-centered. It's the only possible escape from self-centeredness. And self-centeredness is one of the most painful places you can be in. Because things don't happen, they happen to you. There's a big difference. You know what I mean? It doesn't happen. It happens to you. In other words, the tidal wave, as that's coming short, I remember just going, if you were self-centered, you would go, not another tidal wave. You're not even in it. But this, it's inconvenient to even know there's a tidal wave. And you know, why did they have to tell me? I don't want to. I got enough stuff on my plate without a tidal wave. I don't want to hear about tidal waves. And I don't care what it is. I remember one time somebody found another moon around Uranus. And I went, why don't they stop looking? I can't keep track of the moons that are up there now. If you would leave me alone a while, I might be able to calm down. That is self-centeredness. You can't help but take everything personally. And keeping track, and if this would only happen. And when we get to this wonderful spot, I learned a lot. There's two people that I really want to thank as my great, great teachers. One of them is Clancy, and the other one is Chuck Chamberlain. And they showed me ways of looking at things that are entirely different. Clancy specializes by telling stories and myths and for examples and these kind of things. And as he does that, you can see it differently. It has to be done indirectly. You can't talk about spiritual things directly. Stories are the best way of enabling people to see another dimension to their lives. And Chuck, of course, was just the master of it, and I was so lucky to meet him and go down to his house, and I can remember probably in the late 60s going down, and I'd sit in his living room and he'd talk spirituality, and I'd just sit there. I knew it was awesome, but I had no idea what he was talking about. But I knew it was awesome. Because he was talking about things that were at a different level. And then 30 years later, I'm going, so that's what Chuck was talking about. I'm starting to see it. And I feel very blessed that I got to meet him. And so my approach to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I sponsor people, I tell them that I am going to guarantee they have a spiritual awakening, and that's why I'm here. I'm your teacher and I'm your guide. And we're going to go through these steps. And when you finish, you're going to be a different person. You're going to be entirely transformed. And then we start on the journey. We get together 1 hour a week. And it probably takes about 5 months. And everyone has that transformation. It is just there. Everyone who tries it, I won't say there aren't people who just quit, but everyone who tries it has this experience. And if you're new, do not cheat yourself out of that experience. Don't settle for something else. Don't settle for something less. This is the highest life experience that there is to be able to go to the next level and see life and the world through the eyes of your creator. The literature is so replete with precisely how this happens. And I remember early on, I had other goals. I was involved in service. I was involved in this. I was involved in that. But I realized that I was avoiding the very thing that my heart wanted the most. And that was to close the gap between me and my own creator. That there was something built inside of me that told me things weren't right yet. And I did not understand that that signal was I was too far away from my creator. And Dr. Young talked about that in the letter to Bill, when he talked about alcoholics were using alcohol at a low level in their search for God. And that the alcohol itself seemed to fix our spiritual problem of being separated. And It's hard to quantify what that experience has meant to me. I spend a lot of time reading, thinking about this, and trying to talk about it. It's an extremely difficult thing to talk about. It is not something that lends itself to just direct conversations. The thing I remember from Chuck, and I'd like to pass on, it's something that is quoted all the time when we talk about Chuck. He reduced almost the entire problem of being a human being down to these two sentences that he used all the time. When he said there's only one problem that includes all problems, and that problem is conscious separation from God. And there's only one solution that includes all solutions, conscious contact with God. So that means there's no such thing as any other problem. When we say we have a financial problem, we're saying I'm too far away from my higher power. When we say I'm having a sexual problem, we say I'm having a job problem, I'm having a fear problem, we're too far away from our higher power. And as we get closer, the financial problem disappears. Not that money arrives, we just aren't worried about it. And the fear disappears, not that we were given courage, it's just that we just don't feel it anymore. It's a very paradoxical thing to realize it could be that simple. I remember talking to my sponsor, I was saying, are you telling me that there's one solution for all problems? Is that what you're trying to tell me here in Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, how simplistic do you think I am? One solution for all problems. He said, well, wait a minute. What were you doing before you got here? I said, well, He said, did you ever have a problem? And you said, well, here's a problem I won't be drinking over. Or when you had a problem, did you say, oh, my God, I don't know how to handle this, but I will shortly. One, two, three. Three drinks. Yes, yeah, clear as a bell. Tear it up. I don't need to do that. Well, I mean, if anybody understood the principle of one solution for all problems, it's us. I mean, give me a break. And yet when we come in here and we're talking about a power that's much more powerful than alcohol, we question it. And that's the struggle that goes on inside of me and every other human being. It's my ego versus relying on God. My ego versus asking for help. Asking for help is so difficult because I'm going to have to concede that I don't know how to do it. That I don't have all the answers to my own life. It's one of the hardest things to do. And that's where my pride comes in. And I remember when I came in, they said, pride's a character defect. And I went, I'm in the Marine Corps. The few, the proud. That's our motto. And my sponsor was also a Marine. And I said, Bill, I think they're trying to weaken our country. Here in AA. They're trying to talk us out of pride. How could pride be a character defect? This is, you know, and we went through the whole thing. And I just couldn't believe that it was a character defect. And then somebody showed me that it heads the list of the seven deadly sins. And I'm going, good Lord. The Marine Corps has been doing a lot of sinning over these last 300 years. And I realized that we were talking about two different worlds, the material world and the spiritual world. And in the material world, if you just want to operate there, pride can be a wonderful asset. It can spur us along. It can move us towards goals. But it can't make you happy. We will never find peace and happiness except through our connection with our Creator. I've never met anybody that made it except in that way. And it drove me crazy, and I wanted to be the exception. I wanted to find happiness intellectually. I wanted to find happiness on my own. Mostly I wanted to do it on my own. I wanted to be able to come back and go, you're wrong. I don't need all this stuff. How many of us tried that? And then we sat around. We may not have gotten drunk, but we were not happy. But we tried to pretend we were happy. How's it going? Great. Yeah, busy as hell. I'm over here. Yeah, doing great. Doing great. Do you ever think of suicide? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was only kidding. No, I'm not thinking of suicide. I'm thinking of... We don't want to concede there's a turmoil inside of here that won't subside. And we just... And you can't pretend it's not there. After a while, you finally have to just go, I'm freaking dying in here. Well, you want help? No, I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure. Let me think about it. Okay, yes, I want some help, but this is the specific help that I want. No, I'm sorry. We don't operate that way. When you want help, I decide what help you get. And then you carry out what I tell you. Is that good? No, I want to think it over. I got to think it over. So the thing that finally converts us is pain. That's the secret to everything. That's why we don't have to have policemen in AA to make sure people follow the instructions. If we fail to follow them, alcohol is waiting right outside the door. Understand, you don't like to follow instructions. Why don't you have a drink and join me? Okay. And then alcohol takes us for a year or two and says, I think you're ready to go back now. And that's where willingness comes from. The thing that holds AA together is alcohol. It's just sitting out there waiting. Alcoholics pay a heck of a price for trying to do it on their own. They pay a terrible price. But I really understand it. I've worked with guys, and pride is such a powerful force. I remember telling some people standing outside our club. The people inside the club saw me talking to them, and they were actually asking what was going on in there. And I didn't want to tell them because there were people in there that they might have known. And so I said, we're a group of people who can't make it through life on our own. And I came back in and told the people inside, and they said, well, I would have rather you said it's AA than telling them we can't get along on our own. Now, isn't that funny? We're all here because we can't get along on our own, but we don't want them to know. Now, I wonder what that is. I wonder what that is that makes us shy away from asking for help every day. It is the bane of our existence. It's the reason we don't have peace of mind. It's because somehow we're going to figure out how to do this thing on our own. And everyone in AA goes through that. I remember working so hard on the spiritual part of this program. And one of the problems with spirituality is it works. It works. It works like magic. And pretty soon, it took away the problems that you had. You do have peace of mind. You are comfortable in your own skin. You do get along with other people. And you get the sense that you certainly don't need as much help as you used to. You get the sense that you've been placed in a much stronger position than you used to be in. The feeling of desperation is no longer there. There's the sense that I used to need help, but I don't need it now. And that's called spiritual pride. And it just comes in, and pretty soon we're going to have to learn another lesson. I found it with physical pain. I've had a lot of surgeries and stuff and had maybe 4 or 5 years of physical pain. And I found that it was breaking my connection with my higher power. And I was getting self-centered and snapping at people and doing all this. And the thing that was killing me was I couldn't believe that that could happen to me. I felt that my program should have been strong enough to withstand physical pain without batting an eye. That's called spiritual pride. And I had to just suddenly realize, you're just another human being. There's nothing special about you. Get with it. And it's sure nice to have the pain diminish and get back in a bigger comfort level with a little few lessons learned there. It's about time for me to stop, and I wanted to just say something to those of you that are new. The greatest gift you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous is you. That's the greatest gift you're going to get. Because you haven't got a clue what a wonderful person you are. You can't even imagine it yet. And if you stay here, they're going to force all of the false ideas out of you. They're going to take away the wrappings and the garbage. And you're going to start to shine. And other people are going to see it way before you do. They're going to see your eyes changing. And they're going to see your whole posture and your whole being start changing. And eventually you're going to become aware of it. And when you do, you'll probably feel like crying. You will be so happy to find out how wrong you were about everything. The greatest freedom you can have is to enjoy being wrong. So if you have a tough sponsor, tell them to get even tougher. Because there's something inside of you that is going to just please you for the rest of your life. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it for another episode of the Sober Sharers podcast. Thank you for joining us. Please remember to be kind to yourself and others, and we'll see you on the next episode. I love you.